Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Songwriters on Process podcast. My name is Benno Papari, and since 2010, I've run the Songwriters on Process website, where you can find more than 200 conversations with songwriters about the creative process. I'm not here to talk about tour stories, band drama, how a band got its name, or favorite foods. My goal is to treat songwriters as writers, plain and simple. This is an intelligent conversation about the writing process between two writers. And today's interview is with singer-songwriter Josh Ritter. Apologies in advance for my voice, this audio, anything like that. I'm recording this intro from a hotel room in San Francisco, direct to my computer speakers. And last week was the same. I recorded the interview directly to my computer speakers, did not have my usual mic set up. I was also in a hotel room last week as well. So anyway, back to the interview. Josh Ritter, singer-songwriter Josh Ritter, his 11th album, Spectral Lines, came out in April on 30 Tiger Records. Ritter was grew up in Idaho, lives now in New York. Both of his parents have a background in neuroscience, so we certainly discussed the neuro. I've never discussed the neuroscience element with a singer, I don't think. Maybe I did with Yola. The neuroscience aspect of songwriting, but hey, it's there, and we talked about that. A lot of talk about literature, and also his writing process. Ritter is also a novelist, so we talked about his songwriting process as a novelist, as a songwriter, where those things converge, where they differ. And, you know, I find a lot of this conversation, yes, we talked about the ritual and all that good kind of stuff, but this almost wonderment of how people are able, just the wonderment of the writing process in general, and just marveling at how people are able to create, and just the wonderment of all that. So Ritter's a good guy. This was a fun conversation, and I enjoyed a lot. I enjoyed it a lot. Again, his album is called Spectral Lines, and it's out on 30 Tiger Records. And with that, my interview with Josh Ritter. Thanks for taking the time to talk to me. I always start by asking, you know, are you a write every day kind of person, regardless of if you're feeling it, or do you feel like it's better to kind of wait? And we can talk about songwriting or any type of writing, I think, but how important is it to write every day or not to push the issue if you're not feeling it?
Oh, I think it's really, I sort of think that writing is a little bit like starlight, you know, like you can go as far as you want to try and get to it, but it really has to come to you, because whatever it is so far away during so many other normal hours, you know, that I find that like going out and searching for it is not typically very useful for me. You know, I mean, I work all the time. I work a lot. So I typically find that like, that it doesn't take much to make me want to get into the writing space, but you know, like there's a life to be balanced with that. You know, like I think I discovered pretty early on that the number of worlds that I could go to in my mind was infinite, but the world that I had to stay in was this one, you know? And there are so many things that try and drag you away from the world that you're born into, you know, and writing can be one of those things, you know, it can be a drug that just takes you away forever. And, as it is with music in general, you know, there's so I find that like, unless I'm pulled to pick up the guitar, to sit down, then I find that it's usually probably more useful to be doing stuff that is making my family's life a little easier in the now. but I would say that I'm at the spot now in my life where, thankfully, after, you know, 20, 25 years of working, if I don't feel like I have to pick it up, I don't, you know, because that call is so important when it happens that it's not something you necessarily want to muddy with obligation, you know, a sense of personal obligation.
Yeah. So you're okay then with
there's no anxiety. If you're not writing for a few days on end, because you don't feel it happening, does anxiety creep in, or do you feel again like if that's okay because you'd rather not force it? To me, some songwriters do say that there's that anxiety where they feel like even if it's crap, you've got to create every day. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't sound like you're okay with not creating, and there's no anxiety with that if it's not happening. Is that what I'm hearing?
It's not anxiety, because I mean, I remember very clearly the anxiety. It used to be like when you first discover the voice and you have it, you don't know how long you're going to have it, you know? Then, and like, you know, it, especially when you're growing up, like, you know, 17, 18, 19, you've been just seeped in the idea that they're steeped in the idea that everything around you and everything about you is changing all the time, you know? And it's true. Everything about your body, everything about your social life, everything is changing at that age. It's very, I think, understandable to think maybe this voice that I'm hearing is a temporary one. And if I don't squeeze this orange, or, you know, as hard as I can right now, you know, then I'm never going to have orange juice again, you know? And so that definitely was something I lived with for a long time. But now I think that I realized that there are natural wells all over and all around us, you know, but they sometimes you have to dig for them, and sometimes they just show up, and those are the ones that I have to pay attention to. And like a well like that, you go back to it over and over again, it's gonna need time to fill up again. And for me, like having those ideas, I don't want to retread myself, you know, and go over the same ideas over and over again. Because I just didn't give myself the time to have any new ones.
Yeah. As a novelist, does that change though? I mean, as a novelist, I think there's a big difference. I mean, you have to write many more words when you write books. Do you have limits? I mean, is it maybe a certain number of pages, certain number of words? Yeah. Is that process different as a novelist?
Yeah. Like, I think that, well, with a novel, I mean, the great thing about songs, and I think the reason why songs are so fun, is that you get an instant dopamine hit off of a song, you know? And like whether you write it or you listen to it, it's like 3 minutes of being happy or feeling the feeling of whatever it is. And as a writer, you get that sense, and you can really be addicted to it, you know? That sense of accomplishment. And when you move over to prose, I found I had to talk myself into the idea that those rewards were coming, but they wouldn't necessarily come every day, and they wouldn't come every time I finished a sentence like I do a song. You know, when you finish a verse or a couplet and it's just perfect, you can live on that all day, you know, that feeling of like, I got that one, you know. That I call it that butterfly. That one's mine. And like, but with a novel, like, you know, you something like that's 300 pages, you can't sustain that kind of self-satisfaction for that long, you know? And I typically like find that, like, you know, if I'm really writing and I have a good day writing, and it's really, the thing is basically feels like it's writing itself. You know, if I write, you know, I can write like of a rough, you know, maybe 3,000 words. And then I feel like if I write anymore, I just have to get, I have to get up, I have to move away, I have to do something else, I have to ground myself in my life. Because otherwise you get lost in the trying to get satisfaction from something that doesn't give satisfaction that same way as a song.
You know, Hemingway famously said that he would stop writing at the end of the day when he knew that he had something else to say, because he was terrified of starting the next day with nothing in the tank. So he always finished when he knew he had still had something. I think that takes tremendous discipline, doesn't it, to say,
yeah,
I want to say, but I want to save that for the next day because I want to make sure that I'm ready to go, you know, when I start writing. I think that's so interesting. I don't know. I'm curious how you feel about that.
Yeah. You know, I've experienced that a few times where, you know, for instance, during the pandemic, I was working on something that turned out to not be something that I wanted. You know, I wrote something and it was, you know, like many people experience, they write a novel and it's not It's just, it's sort of a changeling of some kind, you know? And it doesn't quite fit what you, it's not quite what you were thinking or wanted, but, you know, I had experiences during the writing process, you know, sometimes during that, where I thought, you know, I have a big day tomorrow because my character is doing this, you know, and it happened a few times, you know, and I remember getting up and getting ready in a way that I hadn't before, because I was preparing for like really, an excursion, a real trip, you know, and those times are fantastic. But I have to say that in terms of self-control, if I know what's going to happen to my character and I have the energy, I just want to get, I'm reading the next couple of pages too, you know?
I'm the same way. I feel there's the anxiety, my anxiety of if I don't get this out now, who knows if it's going to be back. And I don't buy that idea that if it's really good, you'll remember it the next day. Like,
No,
I don't buy that at all. Like, I got to get it out there.
Yeah, always. Oh, man. Speaking of like that with the writing, it's like, I really fully believe in that kind of I think it's the doctor aphorism that if you didn't write it down, it didn't happen, you know?
Yeah.
And more and more as I grow older, I know that to be the case, you know. Right. I have an absolutely bonkers idea, one that like just comes from out of nowhere. And I think, well, there is no way I can forget this, but if I don't write it down on something, if I don't record it somehow, then I just know it's gone.
Yeah. So, you know, speaking of that, songwriters tell me they have endless voice memos on their phone, whether they're lyrics or melodies or anything like that. And there's no sense of organization to them. And I just don't know how they do that, because I imagine you going, oh, where's that idea? And flipping through and saying, where is that? So I'm imagining, are they all on your phone? And is there any sense of organization to them in case you need to go back there?
They are like, all props to the phone. I know that there's aesthetics involved and all that stuff. I'm supposed to write with a feather quill and like, but like I do most of my writing on my phone, you know, I find that like having a notes thing or a word processing app on my phone and then the microphone, like, If I can't get the bones of a song into that, then it certainly has a lot longer to go, or maybe I just need to wait. But yeah, I have just stacks of, I've been recording on my phone and carrying around these notes for like maybe 12 years now, you know, 10 years. Every so often I go through and I pull out ones that like little fragments that I like that I think are cool, and I put them in a doc and I just have them and kind of refresh them, you know, bring them in. I'm working on, I'm going to be going in and playing some demos for my producer next week. And I have about, I just went through and have about 30 kind of random songs and like bits and pieces of little things and stuff that I think might fit. And it's there is no filing process, but going back through the stacks of stuff is like, it feels like me going into like a secret archive that I don't remember.
Yeah. It's fascinating. But on the other hand, some people tell me that that's great, because shuffling through voice memos, you know, they may see something that at first didn't look good, but it's like, actually, that's better than I thought it was. So almost by mistake, you see it and it's like, come to think of it, that might actually be a pretty good idea. I've certainly done that with old stuff that I discarded, and you know, at the moment it wasn't good. And I thought, I'll keep that just in case, but I'll probably never see it. I'm a prose writer, not a songwriter. But still, it's like, I'll go back. This stuff's 10 years ago. And I go, wow, actually, that's got legs now.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so too. I think usually there's like, in terms of songs, like whether listening or writing, like, I don't think there's such thing as a bad, you know, bad music or a bad song, but there's definitely such things as songs that aren't right for their time, you know, and aren't right for their moment, you know, like that, you know, I'll write some stuff that is just kind of just trash, but there's something in there that has, you know, I'd never throw it away. I just keep it because I do know that we're all recombinative creatures. And sometimes pouring some of that old stuff together really forms something new, you know?
Yeah. Funny story, interview speak. Wait, so I just want to clarify. So you're writing lyrics actually on your phone. You're not doing it on your computer. You're writing lyrics on your phone.
Oftentimes. Yeah. I have a, really? I have an iPad and a phone, and I don't use a computer. Like I just have like, and like, I just, and for me, like the portability, being able to take stuff anywhere and being able to capture anything in a complete thought is so useful. I used to use notebooks, and I just, you know, you just carry those around forever. And you know,
right. That's the first, you're the first songwriter I've talked to who doesn't use a computer. I mean, or uses just a phone or an iPad.
Yeah.
That's interesting. I could see the portability, but the story I was going to tell was I interviewed James McMurtry. This is like, I don't know, 7-8 years ago or something. And it was just when they had changed the Notes app on Apple, their Notes app, I'd forgotten, but it used to be yellow. It looked like front is yellow, like a legal pad.
Yeah.
From telling me that he couldn't handle it because they changed the color and he couldn't use it anymore because it didn't look like and it really bothered him. He was like, I wish there was a way that I could change it back. And I was like, there's probably some app that will give you a yellow paper, but that ritual of the yellowness of it, once that was gone, he really struggled with writing on the Notes app.
Yeah. Well, I think that's like it's a microcosm of like the bigger thing that the bigger issue you confront as a human and a writer at the same time. And that is that, like, you know, the world is constantly changing around us. We're constantly changing. And yet what we're trying to do is maintain a practice of something that feels familiar. Like that is one thing that I say, like, I think that from the pandemic, you know, that I learned is that for me, like writing songs, creating, making art, you know, in whatever way gives me a sense of safety. You know, and in some ways carrying my writing around with me is a way, it's almost like a blanket, you know, it gives me that. And things that change in that situation are like huge. They seem so much bigger than what people might assume who aren't working on their Notes app, you know. You know, and don't, you know, I find that true to be, and as notes go, like the formats of those sorts of things, you know, whether it's Evernote or the Moleskin app or the Notes app or Note, you know, all these Notes apps that can organize and do stuff, they're really fun because you start to see your work in a variety of combinations and, you know, put together with other fragments that you hadn't thought about. I think that stuff is really like, it can be weirdly upsetting to your practice, but if you can learn to like to adjust yourself, it kind of makes you more flexible.
So, you know, I want to talk about ritual because I love reading Paris Review interviews with writers, you know, about their rituals. And
yeah,
you know, for me, I think it's at least it's important to have one. When I'm home, I never write and revise in the same chair. I find that I need that distance. And on one hand, like that makes me too rigid, I think. But on the other hand, it's that confidence. Like I do have a chair I like to write in, and I have a chair I like to revise in. But for me, like I need distance. I think if the revision process is too close to the writing process, I'm going to miss stuff. Like I need, you know, so I'll print out, I'll do all the other kind of stuff to make it look different. But I have a chair, chair I revise in. I know that there are certain times of day that I'm the most effective. I'm not a night person, definitely morning person. And I think that's important. But I'm curious, you know, for you at least, is there, you know, how important is that environment? And we can talk about novel, you know, prose or songwriting as far as time of day, place, room, things like that.
Like I think that like that it's that I used to like really pride myself on the fact that I had no real process, you know, and I thought that I, well, my, my strength was that I could write in airports, you know, write in festival port-a-johns, write wherever, backstage, anything that's going on. I still can do that. You know, I can write something that I feel good about pretty much anywhere sometimes, you know, for my, that I myself can feel good. Maybe not other people, but like, and that's really good. But as time went on, I too started to notice there were times and places for different sorts of writing. And like, you know, for me, and especially with the kids now, you know, being the ages there, I've found that, yeah, like the early mornings is my magic time, you know, 5 o'clock to seven, you know, I get up, I get a coffee, I sit at the kitchen table, which is really near the kitchen, which is where I usually work. When I was like first moved to New York, I didn't have a table and all that stuff. I would always write on the floor in the kitchen, you know, where it's kind of warm and the refrigerator's buzzing and all that stuff, you know? And then as time, and so mornings near the kitchen is like great writing time for me. And those are definitely the writing times where I'm writing, I'm inventing, I'm doing the stuff. And I never want to get up in the morning and go back to what I wrote yesterday. You know, I want to like that time is for, the times for revising come about more when I realize I don't have the energy to like make new things up. I have to kind of squeeze in through the doorway and say, okay, I'm going to revise. So I'll go back to the top of what I wrote. And then I realize that I'm just writing again. You know, I'm in there. I'm filling in tons of, it may not be as much a revision as an adding to what I did before, but not moving off into new territory, just expanding and kind of cross hatching the characters a little bit, you know, filling them in a little bit. And, you know, and so sometimes that means that I'll write in the morning for 2 hours using no dialogue punctuation. You know, I'll just like the people are talking, they're having their conversation, stuff is going on. And I just do not need to take the time to go back and get all my P's and Q's, you know? So I'll write very fast without revising, get the main thing and then put it aside. And then, you know, maybe later on or when I'm in a car somewhere or when I'm on the train somewhere, I'll go back and that's when I start to fill in all those other bits and the scene starts to like take on a more formal appearance. But like you say, like, yeah, like early mornings are fantastic for me for imagining and nighttimes are, have become less of that kind of period. I used to think that like night times were when the imagination really cut free, you know, but mostly I'm asleep by then, you know.
Yeah, it's funny. Once you have kids, it's like they're after, I mean, practicality of it, it's a certain time of day, you're just wiped out. I mean, it's nothing more complicated than that. You're just exhausted.
Yeah, yeah. And weirdly, like you have like, I have to always remind myself, like, always that like when I am like when it is like 8:30 and I'm putting Moxie to bed, you know, and I'm just bushed, you know, I'm so that I have to realize that I did my work for the day. You know, I did it at 5 to 7, like that is the time for me to do that work, and now is the time for me to be with my family. And I do find a lot of like joy in thinking about what I've been working on and thinking about in my head and living in those characters a while, but like really like that. Yeah. Finding those specific times has been really good for me, knowing that you can always write, but like finding the times when you are specific and that it fits into your life, doesn't take over.
So
the work is always like, yeah, sorry.
Oh, sorry. No, go ahead.
I was just going to say, I feel like, you know, Haley, my partner, who's also a novelist, is like, she's talked about it about my type of working. And she's like, the work is like a gas, you know, it will always fill the spaces of wherever it can go, you know, but there are fundamentals that it cannot fill. And those are the ones I feel like I have to pay attention to.
Yeah. So a couple of things, I'm not trying to name drop, but when you tell me these stories, it reminds me of what other songwriters have told me. And
yeah.
Britt Daniel of Spoon, I interviewed him about a year ago, and he said when he first started writing, he didn't have a couch, like you were saying. So he wrote on the floor, but now he still likes to write on the floor. He's like, I can afford a couch now, but I still like to write on the floor because I still feel hungry. Like it, I don't, and it, and
yeah.
That still, it's that sense of comfort that he still likes to write on the floor, even though he writes on the floor next to the couch, but it's where he still feels comfortable.
That's that is comforting to know.
Yeah, right. Well, you said that. And then John Darnielle told me that he wrote an entire album at the kitchen table because he said that's where the mojo was. He found that he wrote one song. And he said, you know, the first song he wrote there, he said, well, hey, might as well. That's where it's working. I firmly believe, you know, that we should never revise as we write. And I think you're kind of alluding to that. I mean, when I taught, I would tell my student, and no writer will ever say, you know, revise as you write. Don't write sentence two until sentence one is perfect.
And
there's a great essay by the novelist Anne Lamott called Shitty First Draft that I tell everyone to read because it's all about that, you know, the worst process you can have is to say, oh, I'm not going to write that. I mean, it crushes your momentum as a thinker. If you're going to be that person that says, I can't write this sentence till the one before it is perfect. But I think that's kind of what you're talking about too, is when you're talking about not writing with punctuation and things like that. Right.
Well, you know, I remember seeing, I remember when I was in Rome, I saw that famous Michelangelo sculpture. It's in the Vatican, and she's lying, and she's in ecstasy, you know, and she's being stabbed by a little angel with the heart with an arrow, and I'm way into all the paranormal stuff and all these great stories that happen in religion over history. So I was fascinated with the statue and I wanted to see it, and I saw it. And what I thought was really amazing was that, like, the stuff talking about Michelangelo was like talking about how he carved this thing and how he saw the statue there inside the block of marble. And I thought that was really cool. But what it didn't talk about was the fact that he started with this block of marble in his studio. And that's just not how art works, you know? Yep. Like, Michelangelo had to get that huge-ass block of marble from wherever in Carrara or wherever he... And then they had to drag it, you know, 100 miles and stick it in a studio. And to me, that's where the writing first starts, is like, you got to quarry and drag this huge-ass piece of idea wherever you're going and get it into your studio. And that might be the first draft, but that quarrying and all that stuff was amazingly hard work that you got there, that then you can start to like make it into a novel. But the first draft is like, it's just a block of stone, you know?
Yeah.
And I didn't realize that the first time I wrote, you know, I thought I was carving a piece of stuff. And then like a year later, I realized that I was starting at zero. I was starting with the block of stone, you know, right. And that's beautiful. And it's the same. I mean, I think that's, you know, it doesn't work the same for me with songs. Like with songs, I'm a very tight editor. Like, and really, I think with songs, you know, every line has to be rhythmically correct and have the right interior and outside rhymes and all that stuff. It all has to, and that stuff is like, it's like watchmaking, where you really can't move on to the next thing before you get the dial right. But that's also, and that's a, I think, you know, if I've done that much editing on a novel, but like it takes years, you know, and I do agree with her that like, that you can't look with any like real judgment on what you did first. Yeah, I think she's so smart.
Yeah. And the other thing I wanted, you mentioned this, we were talking about, I think, at the end of the day, feeling like, you know, you've done your work. I always reminded my students when I taught that your writing process, if you only think your writing process is taking place as you're writing, you'll fail. But you have to remember that your writing process is taking place as you're eating, sleeping, working out, walking, talking to your family. That's still the process. And that's so important as a writer that I, you know, I would tell my students that you've got to recognize that. Like, don't just think of it, and that will lessen the anxiety, but recognizing that my writing process is taking place right now, somewhere in there. And I always find that to be a good reminder. If I feel like, oh, I should be writing, I should actually be writing, but I actually am. I just don't know it. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Totally. That fermentation process is like so fantastic. And I feel that like, yeah. And there are times when that process goes too far. And you end up like work. I mean, I've worked on songs sometimes where I'll just be like, I've got to give this one up. You know, yeah. I love this song, but I have like, it's turned now, you know, it lost its charm somehow in the deliberative process. But most often I find that like that all that stuff is really, yeah, we say is working away somewhere in the caudate or wherever it is, and like, yeah, and it has its own time frame, and when it's done, it will tell you, you know, it like the microwave alarm, you know. But I also think like, man, I my thinking on the creative and inspiration and when those big ideas come and stuff like that has changed so much over time. You know, my parents are both neuroscientists, so I was very much raised with the idea that everything happens in our brains. You know, we are these fantastic, like, but you know, now I think we know we are fantastic supercomputers. But we're also receivers, you know, mm-hmm. We receive all this info and many times the writing, you know, especially with songs, I feel really confident saying I didn't write that. I don't know what it was that wrote that, but I was like, I was in my life in the right groove that this thing was, you know, and it was the right time in the world for this idea to emerge this way. And I was here for that. And so like what John Darnielle says about the mojo at the kitchen table, you know, there's I think we all fall into those patterns that make us most receptive to those, or arrange our life, though those of us who have managed to live with whatever it is that makes us writers, those of us that manage to like survive that, or songwriters or musicians or artists in any way, if you can live your life into middle age and an old age, I think you find that you do take on certain habits that make you more responsive to the muse, whatever it is and wherever it comes from.
And I think you have to recognize that. I feel like if you don't at least acknowledge what those are, then you're just not going to make it. I mean, I think you've, like, we may say that, oh, we have no process, but we do. We just haven't really thought about it. Like, yes, there are probably times of the day when I write the best. There are probably things I like to have with me, things I like to be doing, right? I do think you have to recognize that.
Yeah.
You know,
we're biological creatures thinking heavenly thoughts, you know, has to win, you know.
Right. So a lot of songwriters tell me they get, whether they're melody ideas or lyrics, when they're doing repetitive motion that requires no conscious thinking. I mean, I'm talking, it's like gardening, vacuuming, that you know, I've heard crazy things like folding clothes, ironing. They get you know, great ideas when their brains are doing something that requires no conscious thought. And it can be walking. I've heard walking, hiking, swimming, but any kind of activity that doesn't require that, that's when the subconscious tends to bubble up. So does that happen to you?
Yeah, definitely. And I think that, you know, over time I can see that I've taken on various hobbies where that definitely helps. You know, like for a long time I was a marathon. I ran a lot, you know, I did tons of running. And I did that. It was especially before my kids were born, when I had like hours and hours to spend.
Literally. You
know? Yeah, totally. So, but I found that like doing those runs, you know, I got great ideas on those runs, and like, and some of them, like, you know, some of them, that was around the time when I first started using a phone to be able to write stuff down when I was out running. But like, but yeah, like that, that, And they typically tend to be things that like just make your body a little bit better, you know, make your yeah. mental state a little bit more relaxed and I have to say also, you know, for a lot of people, you know, artists of all kinds, you know, we're not typically the most stable, you know, in an emotional, mental way, you know, and that's fine because I don't mind just losing it sometimes, you know, if I get this in exchange. I mean, sometimes it's very, sometimes, you know, like bipolar mental health, you know, those things are, that stuff is, it's a big bear, especially yeah. when you have to discover what it is on your own, you know, as a kid or as like a young adult trying to figure out these things. And, you know, a lot of us need and can be very helped by modern, you know, mental health knowledge and medicine. And I've, you know, when I first started taking medication for my own conditions, like that was like, I was really afraid, you know, I thought like, here I am, I've got this voice that talks to me and tells me things and like helps me write and like, and I'm going to medicate it, you know, I'm going to like to like, and I took the plunge and I've never regretted that, you know. Mm-hmm. Medications come and go, some work, some don't. You always need to get readjusted, you need to stay on top of it, but that has never been something that is I felt has changed the essential its spirit of what I'm trying to say or what I hear, but it does make my body a little bit more able to deal with some of the vicissitudes going on up there.
Yeah. You mentioned running, and I'm a big runner too. And mm-hmm. I wrote an article, this is like 5 years ago, in the Washington Post about the link between executive function, creativity, and aerobic exercise. So especially with your parents as neuroscientists, so this has all been replicated in the lab. And I wrote this article, I can get it to you. It's fascinating stuff. Yeah. But what we found was that there's a chemical in the brain called BDNF, which is brain-derived neurotrophic factor. So what they did was they put people on a treadmill for 20 minutes at 60% max heart rate, which is not much more than a moderate walk. And then afterwards administered a battery of tests to them. And those people always scored higher than people who didn't exercise. And these were tests measuring higher order executive function, which is certainly what we're talking about.
Yeah.
So that benefit lasts about 90 minutes post exercise. So, so when people tell me they get ideas when they're running, there's actually a reason why. And what they found, and I absolutely use this, I mean, I use this as a part of my process. What they found was that the sweet spot is 30 minutes at about 60% max heart rate. So the good news is it's not dose responsive. So 60 minutes isn't twice as good as 30 minutes. And 90% max heart rate isn't any better than 60%, but they found across the board for about 90 minutes that benefits you. But the parameters are interesting because what they found also was that the exercise matters as well. So for example, if you're running, you know, in Brooklyn, it's not as effective as if you're running in the woods, because in running in Brooklyn, you're trying not to get killed by cars. Even treadmills aren't as good as stationary bikes, because treadmills, you're thinking about balance a little bit. So it's got to be an activity that ideally requires no thought at all. But there's so much it's fascinating stuff. I wrote about this because as a runner, I
will look that up. I've got the Washington Post. Yeah.
I wrote it. So I've done it. There's two things. I did it for adults because it has tremendous benefits in the workplace. I mean, people who sit for all the day, they're doing it all wrong. But also the research shows that it's incredibly beneficial for kids with ADHD. That exercise for any kids, but kids with ADHD, that's especially beneficial to them. So, okay. So literary inspirations. I know you're a voracious reader. And I do find that songwriters, you know, and I don't think you can be a good writer of any stripe unless you read. It's not possible.
Yeah.
And so I'm curious, are you a genre person when you like to read? Or are you an author person? You know, who do you like to read?
Oh, I get, you know, I'm not a genre person because like I found that like when I was growing up, especially my parents were big readers, but tremendously varied. I mean, the one thing they really didn't read very much of is in terms of their interests, they were varied, but they didn't really read a lot of fiction. Mm-hmm. You know, later on, but after I left home, they started a poetry group in their community and they really like got into poetry and reading poetry to each other, all kinds of stuff. But really when I was like, you know, my tastes have always kind of gone in all different directions. And I find that like what I want to read at the moment or the information I want to take in somehow is very closely related to the writing, to the feeling of wanting to write. You know, I remember, you know, I find that it's beautiful to follow your interests when they jump into your head. Like, mm-hmm. That's so, so wonderful, because if you get an idea that like, oh, you just want to like, you want to learn like about Canadian history, all for instance, one day you just wake up and be like, you know what? I don't know anything. You know, I want to know. And like, it's good to know that stuff, but it's also like, to suddenly look up from what you're doing and notice a huge big expanse of mm-hmm. something that you've never had any experience with, you know, that's beautiful. Like I wanted to, you know, so, you know, whether it's history or religion or philosophy or science, you know, then, you know, just all the amazing work that's coming out every day. You know, it's kind of like it's a kid's candy store. You know, there's so much to read that like I find that if I start to get into like a particular genre, I sort of like find myself wanting to like break out of it and like, you know, maybe color it with something else, you know, something totally different, you know, yeah. What, you know, like an autobiography about like, you know, whatever it should be, like a cook in a kitchen or whatever it should be, you know. But I mean, in terms of writers, like one of the gold standards I always hold stuff I write up to is Muriel Spark. Mm-hmm. I think that she is like, her writing, Muriel Spark's writing is like, is fully, like it's like holding up a crystal, you know, like holding up a really perfectly cut stone, because her writing isn't long. It's very condensed. The plots are super sharp and super. You really care what's going on, but like, and she really allows her characters so much space to develop their own voice. And but she does it with such concision, you know, that I think that she's incredible. I love Pete Dexter. I think Pete Dexter is one of just my favorites. I've loved everything by him, you know, but then there have been other books that, you know, I don't know as much about the authors, but their work has been foundational, you know, whether it's like Barry Hanna, or I remember I really, you know, Richard Brautigan was somebody that I would pick up and read, not all the way through, but read. I think I've read almost everything by him over time, mostly because I like the style of his writing. I like his informal voice, you know. I like that he's kind of a horny guy in his like, and you know, and it comes out in his work, you know. He's like, I like so much about so many different people. And I found that with music, it's the same. It's not about whether it's like, I like it or not. It's about what do I appreciate, you know, about it, you know, what is it that makes me, what is it that makes it work? You know,
I've got a book recommendation for you. I know that you know, with your background, you know, from being from Idaho, Joe Wilkins, is a fantastic novelist. His book is called Fall Back Down When I Die. I interviewed him about a year ago. He's a professor. I think he's a professor in Montana, but he writes, cool. He's an incredible novelist, but his his Fall Back Down Would I Die is about kind of the land rights. It's a work of fiction, but it involves like the land rights issue between the government and the ranchers and people out there in Montana. But his descriptions of the of nature, just stunning. And he's a poet. I didn't tell you he's a poet. And what like novels, and it's good. That's my favorite. Because you get a plot that moves, but the descriptions are, I mean, literally poetic.
Yeah. He's a
fantastic writer.
Oh, that's so cool.
Yeah. So, anyway.
Well, that's like, you know, I like A.S. Byatt, who I always liked her writing, or what's his name? Umberto Eco. Both of those writers who are like, they write, like, their books are longer and much more, like, complicated. But man, the rhythm of the words, like, I think that is so beautiful. Like the rhythm of the words, and like, I guess that is something where, like, when I sit down and write, and I'm writing my in the mornings, you know, I always get the rhythm right. You know, I still can't move on from the sentence unless it has the rhythm, you know, to it. But like, that's not as important, you know, that's down the line, that may change, but like, it's still that rhythmic, the poetic writing is still like, it seems so important.
And that's it for the latest episode of Songwriters on Process. Don't forget, you can find all of my interviews with over 200 songwriters on my Songwriters on Process website at songwritersonprocess.com, going all the way back to 2010. You can read them, watch them, or listen to them. So until next time, thanks for listening.